Let's begin with a prayer. We thank you, Heavenly Father, for our blessings and for the continued guidance of the power of your Holy Spirit that you give to each of us as we are able to continue to delve into these things. Bless us as we serve you and learn. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I'll just open it up. See what, if you have any questions or anything in particular to talk about with this. With this chapter. Actually, what really kind of sets the tone, if you have, I need to pick up a Bible here. What really sets the tone is Jesus' baptism. If you want to turn to the first chapter of Mark, I'll just kind of start off here giving a little bit of an introduction. And this introduction is modeled after teaching, I don't want to disturb the microphones here, this class. And if you ever have a chance, this is See Through the Scriptures. This is a condensed version of the Divine Drama. And it is a very, very good course for getting a good perspective on the Old Testament. Everything that is presented in a concept over here is presented in a kind of a graphical form here. And they all have overheads with them. And it's just an amazing thing. As a matter of fact, it's one of those things, too, where you kind of have to start in the beginning in order to get the full sense of it. But this is where some of this comes from. Now, what we're going to look at here, just to kind of get us started, this gives us a good character or a good idea of Jesus' earthly ministry. And we're looking at Mark chapter 1, verse 11. This is after Jesus. First of all, you go back to chapter 1, verse 9. And it talks about Jesus going to the waters of the Jordan River to be baptized by John the Baptist. And it's and then gives just a very brief account, as Mark gives fewer details and compresses his thoughts a little bit better. And then it comes up to verse 11 with the words, "You are my son whom I love, with you I am well pleased." Or however it might read in a particular Bible translation that you are using. Actually, this one says, "I am delighted with you." Now, that sentence, or those two sentences, or however, but that statement, that phrase that God spoke over his son, is a combination of two very important Old Testament passages. And one of those is out of Psalm 2. I believe that it is Psalm 2, verse 7, if my memory serves. I didn't write it down. And that is the words, "You are my son." Now, Psalm 2 was the coronation psalm for the Israelite kings. So whenever there was a king that was crowned, the king was told, "You are my son." So somebody look up Psalm 2 and make sure that I got the verse right.
It is.
It's Psalm 2, 7?
Yes.
Okay. And so whenever a king was crowned in Israel, Psalm 2 was the coronation psalm. In Psalm 2, 7, "You are my son." The king was seen as God's spokesman, as God's personally ruling representative to the people, and therefore was considered to be the son of God in a sense. Now, you don't want to take that too far, because the kings were not divine like the son of God, Jesus Christ. It was considered to be God's son in the sense of being the king. Very early on also, by the way, this is just a bit of an aside, the kings, after the promise that God made to David, were all called, no matter how many generations from David, were all called son of David, which is why the Pharisees got so fighting mad on Palm Sunday when they heard all that stuff going on with the Hosannas. Because it was, you might as well have been shouting the word Messiah as far as they were concerned, because it's exactly what they heard. So Psalm 2, verse 7, "You are my son, whom I love." And then the rest of the phrase comes from Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1 is out of what are called in Isaiah the suffering servant songs. Okay? So you've got these two concepts that are being wedded together. Here you have the Son of God standing in the water to be baptized. His baptism was, in effect, his commissioning into his messianic office, into his divine office, the beginning of his ministry. And we are told with these two phrases, "You are my son whom I love. You're a king." That's what those words imply. And then, "with whom I am well pleased," out of the quote out of Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1, "you are a king who is a servant." And it sets the whole tone for the ministry of Jesus. You are a king. You are a king who has come to serve. Now, it's very interesting, the way that Pastor Wendt in his Divine Drama Courses identifies the rest, or goes through then the rest of the chapter of Mark. Because what he does then is he goes through the rest of Mark up until Mark 7:27, I believe. No. 8:26. From that point on in the book of Mark until 8:26, what you have is one miracle right after another. Because in the Old Testament, there were four specific promises that were made as to who Messiah, how Messiah was going to be recognizable. And those four specific promises were that he was going to have power over sickness and disease, which strikes at the very basis of the human condition in a way of, you know, bringing our bodies down to death. That he was going to have power over nature. That he was going to have power over demons. And that he was going to have power over death itself. And so what you see then from Mark chapter 1, beginning with verse 12, and well, actually 12 and 13 are his temptation in the wilderness, an identification of that, but especially beginning with Mark 1:21, you see Jesus fulfilling each of these four things. Mark 1:21 starts off with Jesus driving out a demon. Power over demons, power over sickness, power over nature, and power over death. And over the next chapters, up until 8:26, you see casting out demons, you see miraculous healings, you see miracles relating to nature, such as the stilling of the storm, and you see Jesus raising people from the dead. It all culminates then in 8:27, with Jesus coming to his disciples and asking the question, "Who do people say I am?" And after a bit of speculation in chapter 8 of Mark, verse 28, Jesus zeroes in and says, "Who do you say that I am?" And then that's when Peter makes his marvelous confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." All of these things up through this part of the book of Mark have been identifying Jesus as the Messiah. But the question mark that remained, even after Peter made his comment of his bold confession in Mark 8:30 or 29, is what kind of Messiah? Well, the question of what kind of Messiah was answered already in his baptism. He was a king who had come to serve. But now he answers it point blank, beginning in verses 31 to 33, when he says, Then he said to them, "The Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. He must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life." That's what kind of Messiah . So I thought that would just kind of be a good introduction here to our discussion of the person of Jesus Christ. And it's very interesting, I think, the way that Pastor Wendt puts all those things together and talks about all that. If I can find that illustration in here real quick, to show you how he graphically... I don't even know if it's in this book or not. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, 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 yes. There it is in graphical form. There you have the baptism of Jesus and the putting together of Jesus as servant and Jesus as king. And then you have Jesus, and then you have, this is the first part of Mark leading up to Mark 8:26, where he has power over disease, power over nature, power over demons, and power over death. And then the question mark, what kind of Messiah is he? And then he goes on to another illustration, and he talks about the kind of Messiah that he's going to be, the kind of Messiah that dies. And each time he talks about his death, it is right after a significant event. In this particular case, he talks about his death the first time right after Peter identifies that you are the Messiah, and he tells what kind of Messiah. Then his transfiguration, which is the showing of his glory, and then he talks about his death again. And then finally he says, we're going to Jerusalem. He talks about his death again. He makes his case to set himself resolutely toward Jerusalem. So, anyway, as you can tell, I'm sold on this course. I really like it. I teach this for confirmation class for the 7th and 8th graders. And I just think it's just wonderful that you've got all of the wording on one side of the page, and on the other side of the page, you've got graphical representations of what all that is saying. And it just, I teach it one week, and then the next week I turn right around and I throw the transparency up on the screen and I say, tell me what I told you last week. And you usually come pretty close to it. Okay, so we want to talk now about what you read. Do we want to just go through these Bible passages? This study guide was a little different in the fact that there's just a whole bunch of Bible passages talking about Jesus. Or do we want to go on to the concepts there on the in the questions themselves? How do you want to approach this tonight?
I would prefer talking about the concepts.
The terms, starting with terms and people?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Bible passages, we should be fairly familiar with all.
Okay. Anybody have any particular issues with any of the Bible passages? There you see down part of the column, Isaiah chapters 42, 49, 50, 52, 53, all identified, suffering servant. That's what I quoted. The 42:1 is the very first one that's listed there, which is the second half of what God the Father said when Jesus was baptized. Okay.
The problem I had was I thought P-H-I-L was funny.
Ah!
But upon discovering that there wasn't a second chapter, I said, maybe I need to rethink what P-H-I-L could possibly be.
Yeah. Okay.
So what's the typical abbreviation for Philemon?
P-H-L-M-N or P-H-L-I, you know, something. I don't know
it's
exactly.
It's such a rare word they don't have.
I guess so.
Yeah.
In
the
original, in mine, it's P-H-I-L-E-M.
Okay.
So you're almost there.
Once I discovered there was no second chapter, I said, you know.
I thought that myself.
Well, just scanning this down a little bit.
Mistake.
Scanning this down a little bit, some of the notable passages here would be 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 4 to 17. That is what I quoted, or that's what I was vaguely referencing earlier when I talked about Son of David. That's talking about him a king. David has this grand idea. David is in this wonderful, expansive mansion for a palace. And he looks down one day at the temple of the Lord, which is this tattered up tent that they've been dragging through the wilderness for 40 years and then had ever since he'd been king. And kind of one of these, what's wrong with this picture, you know? And I'm living in this palatial mansion and the church is this dilapidated tent. And so he decides that he's going to build the Lord a temple. And God comes to him through Nathan and says, too much blood on your hands, pal. You can't do it. But I will, he turns, it's a play on words. He says, you will not build a house for me. Does the Lord live in a house? Does the Lord dwell in a house? And he says, and he turns it around and makes a play on words. But I will make of you a house. It was a promise. It was one of the two major covenants of what is called divine commitment in the Old Testament, meaning that no matter what the people that it was promised to did, it was going to come through anyway. The other covenant of divine commitment was made back in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, where God promises Abraham that he's going to be a great nation and he's going to have land and offspring, and that one of his descendants was going to be a blessing to all the nations, talking about Jesus in chapter 3, verse 12 of Genesis. Now we come down to 2 Samuel chapter 7, especially verse 13, and that is where now we find out that Messiah is going to be of the royal line of David. That a son of David, that a descendant of David, is always going to rule over God's people. Which led to some very interesting question marks in the minds of the Israelites when they were all sitting in Babylon crying in their beer after Jerusalem had been destroyed in 586. Because one of the things that the Babylonians did, they were real nice people, those Babylonians, you know, they set the king up, who was the last descendant of David. They killed all of his sons in front of him, before his eyes, and then they poked his eyes out. And then he died in exile. And all at once now the people are saying, wait a minute, God made a promise all the way back to David, and now we don't have any more David's people around here. What are we going to do? So that now becomes the source of the expectation of Messiah coming up into the time of Christ. It's going to be a son of David. Daniel 7 is also an interesting passage from the standpoint that this is an identification that the deliverer, Messiah, was going to be true God, but also look like a man. Now, don't take that too far into saying that, you know, because there's some of the heresies you read about, too. We're talking very much that way. But you have to keep in mind that God is slowly unraveling this stuff to his people over a thousands of year kind of period. Matthew 26 ties into that. The suffering servant songs, Isaiah 42, etc. Jesus called God in John 20. Philippians chapter 2, verses 4 to 11 is the standard epistle lesson for Palm Sunday. Actually, it's 5 to 11. It's the standard epistle lesson for Palm Sunday. And the reason for that is because that is the clearest passage in the entire New Testament that talks specifically about the humiliation and the exaltation of Jesus. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. Now, it is good, if you have a number of translations, to read that in a number of translations, because the Greek of Philippians chapter 2 is difficult. And as you read a number of different varying translations, you're going to see a pretty wide variance on the original, the long-standing English translation was while being in the very form God, did not consider equality with God something to hold on to. And then the NIV makes it the very nature of God. It's because it's very, very difficult. It's basically he was God in every respect, the NIV is weak in the second part of that phrase when it says, who being in the very nature of God did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. Now, that doesn't mean that he was continuing to reach for it and didn't quite have it. It meant that it was his, but he didn't feel like holding on to it to such an extent of, it's mine, you're not going to take it away from me. He willingly laid it aside. That is the sense of that verse. But again, the Greek construction is real complicated and a little bit confusing there, and translators have had a very difficult time with that whole thing there in Philippians 2. But that is the Latin would be Sedis Doctrina, the chief doctrinal passage for the humiliation and exaltation of Christ, Philippians 2, 5-11. And then John 1, 1-14, that's actually one of my favorite passages. Talks about Jesus coming in a different sense. That brings up something too, because John 1 uses the backdrop of creation in Genesis 1 mm-hmm. to introduce the concept of the coming of Jesus. And I love the way that Kolb said that, something along the line of the introduction of the recreation of humanity was set into the context of the creation of the world or something like that. I thought that was a real eloquent way of putting that. the other thing about that just brings up something else too. If you ever have somebody that says, I don't understand this thing called the Bible and it just gets too confusing and so forth, tell them to read Genesis and John for that very reason. Because there you have where we started, what happened to it, and God's repeated attempts to reach out to try to, I mean, not to try to straighten it out as if he couldn't, but just simply, you know, the repeated reaching out to God, that God did to humanity and humanity's pulling away, you know, with the Cain and Abel and the flood and the Tower of Babel and all this kind of stuff, and the beginning of Israel with the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all that kind of stuff. And then you have the, as Cole put it, the story of the recreation as John. As they start off with the same words, but for a very specific reason. There's a very, you know, mm-hmm. very close tie together there. Anyway, that's for the Bible passage. That's all I've got to list. Why don't we talk about the questions right under those then, and then we'll go on with terms and people. What's important to remember about the varying titles and descriptions of Jesus, both from the Bible and the early church?
Well, some of the things, of course, that are picked up are that he is explained in both places. They are tied together. The other thing that I caught, whether it was from what Kolb was saying or from reading them themselves, was the concept of the words that were used were words that the people could understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that it wasn't something that was beyond their grasp. How can we put it in, as we would say today, how do we put it in our context? Well, that's what I saw happening throughout the readings.
Okay, yeah. That's an important concept, too, because, you know, it goes back even to the days of when we were talking about what Bible translations to use and some of that kind of thing. As God speaks to his people in their language, you know, as you take a look at the way that the most of the Old Testament was written in the Hebrew language, which is the language of God's people, but the later parts of the Old Testament that were written when they were exiles in Babylon, all their kids were going to schools and learning Aramaic, and so the Bible, was some of it was written in Aramaic. Then Alexander the Great conquers the world at 330 B.C., and Greek is just spread like wildfire. I always thought that was kind of an interesting fluke of history. You know, Alexander he lived shorter than any empire builder around, and yet the language that he spoke became a kind of a universally accepted language to the known world, at least as far as language of trade and commerce, and provided then, you know, within that 300-year period of time, provided a wonderful launch pad for the New Testament and the coming of Christ and the spread of the message into the whole world, instead of it just being particularized to the Hebrew people.
Right.
You know. So, yeah, God speaks to his people in their language, very much so. And into concepts that they can understand.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on that one?
If you didn't know the Old Testament names, the New Testament wouldn't make any sense to you. Like, one thing I really got out of studying this was what Son of Man really meant. I mean, I've heard it all the time, but I didn't realize the historical content of it.
Mm-hmm. He does a good job putting that into Daniel. And just one, not that I'm doing commercials for that, but that's one of the beauties of this course too, is the Divine Drama, is that he gives you the Old Testament background in a very solid way for the New Testament, you know, for the coming of Christ. You know, the whole, he puts a lot of emphasis on the exile, which is a very important thing to do. It's something that, as I was growing up before I became a pastor, I don't even remember having that much emphasis on it, because the exile is a critical turning point in a lot of cases for the conditions that developed, is why Jesus shows up on the scene and his own people say, "Who are you? We don't know you." You know, and not only do we not know you, but we don't want to know you because you're so different than what we were expecting. Mm-hmm. Well, why were they expecting something different? The exile is the big answer. But anyway, yeah, anything else on that one then? Okay, what two things are affirmed by the doctrine of the virgin birth?
Well, but he was born.
Yes. Which is a truly human kind of thing. It's one of the things I point out to my confirmation kids. Why do we call Jesus Christ true man? He was born, you know.
And yeah. He was born to a virgin,
mm-hmm.
not normally.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. What two challenges did the church meet by dog? And that's there was a G left out of that dogmatizing, I think, in your papers.
Yeah.
Dogmatizing its teaching on the person of Christ.
Well, I had to struggle with heresy in the church and attacks from outside of the church.
Okay.
Well, and also this idea that a lot of cultural things impacted on how people viewed the person of Christ.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, I think though that what he was actually aiming at, from what I heard, is that there was either a denial of his true human nature or that he was true God.
Yeah, the pendulum kept swinging back and forth.
Yeah.
To counteract the pendulum one way, they would overdo it the other way.
Yeah.
And it very often happens. You know, it's there was a huge heated debate. There were a lot of huge heated debates in the 16th century. One of them, one of the books that this guy's going to get to read at seminary, is called Historical Introductions to the Book of Concord. And it's, get high-powered glasses.
Okay.
The type is about 6 point or something. It's incredible.
And
it's dry. It is dry as the sands of Arabia. It's terrible. But it gives you some background as to each one, because especially for the formation of the Formula of Concord, which was finalized in 1577, there were a whole series of controversies that went into making that. One of them was the controversy on original sin. And exactly what you're describing, the pendulum swing happened, is that one theologian was saying that original sin wasn't as big a deal, in effect. And then the other one came along and said that it was such a big deal that he actually stumbled into the territory that was created substance. That it was part of the created being. Well, that made God the creator of evil, then, if you go that far. So it was a pendulum swing. One of them was saying, it's just not that big a deal, and that kind of thing. And then the other one was making such a big deal out of it that he made it a created part of the human condition. And that made God the creator. That implied God being the creator of sin. And it just, so exactly. It's just one of those things. You take it to an extreme and you wind up in trouble. The last paragraph discusses the distinction between the person of Christ and the work of Christ. To what significance does Kolb draw the reader's attention?
Well, it's really the reconciliation of God to us through Christ.
Anything else on that?
I felt he was putting a priority on it.
Priority in what way?
In that it was more important that we look at Christ as our salvation. It was the higher valued thing than all the explanations of what he actually was, physically or spiritually.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, and he talked about the work of Christ being restoring the peace that was in Eden.
Okay.
Whereas the person of Christ was how he did this by shedding his blood on the cross.
Okay.
To draw the distinction between the mechanism and the end result.
So, that's kind of what I was hearing, from the sense of an identification versus the function, so to speak. That it is important to hear Christ, who Christ is, being uniquely God and man, putting him in a position of being the one uniquely qualified to be our Savior. And then that's the identity part, and then the work part is that he actually went on to accomplish it. Anything else on that? All right, terms and people. Of course, Messiah, that just goes without saying, Messiah is the Hebrew word from the Hebrew transliteration, so to speak. Christ comes from Christos, the Greek transliteration. Same thing, it means anointed one. It goes back to that concept of the anointing with oil, the setting apart, the consecration aspect of the work of Christ, of the work that Christ had come to do. Okay, one like Son of Man and Son of Man.
Describing Jesus as a human.
Mm-hmm. God in human flesh. Some of the ways in which he put some things I thought were, even with all the theological reading I had done over the years, I liked what he had to say there. It sharpened things up for me a little bit. That whole business coming out of Daniel, and even I'm thinking too, I don't recall him saying much about Ezekiel, but Ezekiel ended up being called Son of Man quite often too.
Daniel's in heaven.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I taught a class on that about 9 years ago, and it is. It's Daniel and Revelation are probably the two toughies in the Bible. They're both apocalyptic, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, Daniel is tough. The big key to both of those is most of what is being said that sounds literal is symbolic, as far as specific numbers and things like that. What was I doing today? Next Sunday's gospel is Matthew 24, and talks about it's Jesus. Starts right off, the gospel lesson starts right off with, and when you see the abomination that causes desolation set up in the temple, let the reader understand. And that is a reference back into Daniel. And then I was looking, and Daniel in chapter 4, or chapter 12, I believe it is, makes reference to something like time, times, and half a time. And that has been variously packed and unpacked and figured and refigured and so forth, and ends up being about 1260 days if you take it as a year, 2 years, and a half a year. But it actually, as I'm recalling, it's the 3.5 is half. I think that the significance I wound up with when I was teaching that class, if I recall, it's been 8 years now or more, was 3.5 is half of 7. And so he's talking about that, the Old Testament half of the church. And then 7 would be the entire time of the church. I teach that sometime too. I got a whole stack of papers on that, of course. Suffering servant.
Well, the concept of the king who serves and can't understand our grief and sorrow and pain and all those kinds of
things. Okay. So we have someone who specifically identifies with us.
Right.
As opposed to a being that either just has sympathy for the poor slobs down on earth or whatever, you know.
Right.
Probably the Bible passage that comes to mind on the suffering servant concept is the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. That's the one that is most often read presented in some form on Good Friday. Who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He had no former comeliness that we should acknowledge him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. He was bruised for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The something that brought us peace was upon him, and by his stripes,
the
chastisement that brought us peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. That's the one. It's about 13 verses long. Anything else on the suffering servant? Yahweh compared to Lord.
Well, Yahweh was the name for Jesus that in the Old Testament they wouldn't speak. They They were afraid that if they would say it incorrectly, they would be struck down.
Second commandment, very literally.
Yep.
Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That means don't even mispronounce it. It's tough to get life insurance for scribes, so they decided to use another word instead.
Well, it was the word for God, though, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was the divine covenant name. And it goes back to Exodus chapter 3, and I think it actually particularizes on verse 14, if I remember it correctly. Because Moses and God were having this little argument in front of the bush. That's why Moses voted for Gore in the last election, you know, because the last time he listened to a bush, it got him in all kinds of trouble. Anyway. Sorry. Had to throw that in. Got him in all kinds of trouble last time he listened to a bush. When Moses was having an argument with God at the bush, burning bush, Moses was trying to find any excuse in the book that he possibly could, and even write a few of his own, as to why he was not the one to go in front of Pharaoh saying, "Let my people go." He did not want to do this. He says, "I am happy with sheep. Sheep are cool. We like this. We'll stay right here." And and part of the argumentation, he says, "Suppose I go to the Israelites." You like the way he couches this. "Suppose I do this, God, you know, even though you're ordering me, suppose I decide to follow you up on it. Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say, 'Well, what is his name? Then who should I tell them sent me?'" And that's when God says, "I am who I am." The word Yahweh is a derivative of the Hebrew word to be, the Hebrew verb to be, which is I am. It's the great I am. A classic use of this in the New Testament applied to Jesus is John chapter 8, verse 58. I believe that's it. Jesus is having this little friendly argument with the Pharisees that had culminated from the John 6 business of the bread, free bread in the wilderness jazz, the feeding of the 5,000. The crowds were following him because they were dazzled and awed, and they wanted somebody to give them free bread the rest of their lives. And he starts into a discussion of what his real messianic office was all about. And the people were getting a little more irritated all the time. They start into this, by chapter 8, they're getting into this spat about who Abraham was and their relationship to Abraham. They basically, you know, the Jews felt entitled. They had been oppressed for 850 years by one empire after another. And so by the time that they thought Messiah was going to come, they thought that was their entitlement to be the dominant world empire once again, that was going to show all these nasty Gentiles that God is really God. And they were just waiting for that time to come. And as they become interested enough in Jesus to think he might be the guy, they're having this discussion about Abraham, and Jesus comes along, and I think it's in John 8, 58, and he says, "Before Abraham was, I am." And their reaction is to pick up rocks and throw at him, because he was using I am in the sense of Yahweh, the divine name.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was unspeakable.
So he spoke it.
Mm-hmm. He said, "I am." Yeah.
And nothing happened to him except...
So except they wanted to kill him.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not like... So they're saying, "See, you can say that."
Yeah, yeah, but it's...
Lightning didn't come down from heaven.
But it was because of a literalistic reading of the Old of the Second Commandment that they didn't speak it at all. Yeah, that name anyway. And in your NIVs, if you're using NIV, whenever in the Old Testament you see the word Lord with a capital L and small capital O-R-D, that is Yahweh. Some English translations use Yahweh. Some have elected to follow the Hebrew pattern of not using it at all and making a substitute. Because what would happen when the scribe was reading along, the scribe would come along and he would see the word Yahweh. He wouldn't pronounce that one. He would instead use the pronoun Adonai, which means Lord. And then in the 9th century, when the... and in the 9th century, I want to bore Kathy because she's heard this already, I know, in this, catechism class. In the 9th century, when they decided that they were forgetting how to see, up until the 9th century A.D., Hebrew was only consonants. There were no vowels. Because it was a spoken language, not a written language. So in the 9th century, because Israel had been out of existence for almost 1,000 years of the destruction of Jerusalem by General Titus in 70 A.D., the 9th century, they, there were some scribes that sat down and figured out they'd better figure out a system of identifying what those sounds were for this language that had basically gone dormant. And they came to the divine name. And either they didn't want to let anybody know how it was pronounced, or it had been unpronounced for so many years, they didn't even know how it was supposed to be pronounced. And so, since Adonai was the accepted substitution, they hung those three vowel sounds on those consonants, A-O-I, or A-O-A. So then, the King James bunch comes along in the early 17th century to translate the King James Bible into English, and they see Y-H-W-H, or, which also tends to be interchangeable, Y and J, and W and V, and they see Yah, the A, the A of Adonai, and the O of Adonai, and the A of Adonai, and the Y-H-W-H, or J-O-V-H, Yahovah. That's where that came from. It's an illegal construction in Hebrew.
If
Jehovah is as those two as a combination of that group of vowels and that group of consonants is an illegal construction in Hebrew. What the scribes meant to do was what we would do with an asterisk in English and stick a footnote in the margin saying, don't say this, say instead the Lord. But that was their way of doing it. But they didn't know that it was an illegal construction in 1611, and so they just translated it Jehovah. That's why you don't hear the word Jehovah, except for the religious group that has adopted that, and some of the old King James translations that continue to use it today. Because... that, and Yahweh comes now as the closest approximation, we think, or scholars think, to what that pronunciation actually was. So,
in everyday language, how do they say I am? I mean, don't we say this all the time? You know, I am hungry, I am light, I am...
Well, the verb to be, first of all, the verb to be is an option in Hebrew, as it is in some other languages too. Now, a lot of times the verb to be will just simply be omitted, and if you have two concepts that are put up against each other, you just simply know that the verb to be is an assumed part of it, but it's not actually written or spoken out of that. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 is a place in the Hebrew where that is true. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, is the way I believe it reads in the NIV. The actual literalistic translation of that from the Hebrew would be Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord one. And they did that specifically because they didn't want anything between the Lord and one. They wanted to make sure that that identification was so closely made. But Yahweh is a derivative. It is not the words I am. It's based on the concept and upon the I am the actual verb to be is the root, but it isn't the actual word. Anything else on Yahweh compared to Lord? Of what that is, then, with that long-winded explanation, is not just trivia. Yahweh compared to Lord, Yahweh is the divine covenant name as opposed to Lord, which is kind of like a title. So, because Lord was a typical title like Sir or Herr in the German. It's very interesting in, I believe it's in Acts chapter 9, is it? Paul's being struck down on the road to Damascus. And he hears the voice saying, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he turns around and says, "Who are you, Lord?" There's a lot of discussion among commentators as to whether that's supposed to be capitalized or not, based on the fact of whether or not he's addressing him as Lord, as in God, or Sir, who are you? Many people think he didn't know who he was talking to until Jesus turned around and said, "I am Jesus who you're persecuting," and so it shouldn't be capitalized. It was just a title like Sir.
Well, yeah, you don't know who's... what power is behind you, you would use the utmost of respect in addressing that person.
You would use the utmost respect, but you might not necessarily assume that they're God.
I mean, it was just Sir.
Exactly. God. Yes, Sir. Really, you have my attention. I'm blindly flat to dust here.
It's just like when you address a letter to someone at the university, you always use doctor because you never know if they're Mr. or or whatever you always...
You know, honor the ones that are and flatter the ones that aren't.
Exactly.
That's okay. All right. The concept of word, which John makes a very, very strong case for in the first chapter of his book as he's identifying and introducing Jesus. The concept of word.
Tying together the concept of Jesus with word, the things that I wrote, Jesus, God's word and God himself. The word delivers God's power and served as his creative and preserving instrument.
Yeah. Anything else? That's good, Alan, and that's right. I think John, I don't remember the exact verse now. It seems like it's in the teens someplace, 1:17 or so. No one has seen God at any time, but God, the one and only, who has come from the Father's side, has made him known. And you think about the whole concept of what is the purpose of words? What do words do for us?
Help us understand.
Exactly.
Help us express. Yeah.
Help us to understand, to express, to reveal to us, to you know. And this is exactly the function of Jesus. Which I would argue then that every time God was in a tangible form, apprehendable, so to speak, in the Old Testament, that it was Jesus. Not necessarily Jesus, the incarnate, at that point, because this was pre-incarnate Christ, but it was the second person of the Trinity before, you know, he became incarnate, but it was still the second person of the Trinity. We're talking about places like when Abraham stood talking to the Lord in Genesis 18:19, right before Sodom and Gomorrah were wiped out, that was the pre-incarnate Christ. Even then, the Shekinah, the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that led the Israelites out of Egypt, led them all the way through the wilderness, that indeed was the pre-incarnate Christ. Anything else on word? Logos in the Greek is what it's called. The Greek word. It's a real packed term. Also, we could spend a whole night talking about that. I couldn't because I'm not prepared to, but I do know that there's just gobs and gobs of stuff out there on the background of logos in the Greek as a concept and how that was used to relate to Christ. And it goes a lot deeper than even Kolb did in this book. Son compared to Father.
I thought it was a way of bringing about that it's just a way to distinguish the difference, or that the separateness of Father from Son, but yet they're one and the same.
Mm-hmm. In the economy of the Trinity, that's right, yeah. As I teach confirmation, I find it to be almost easier to tell the kids what the Trinity is not than what the Trinity is. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's not three gods. It's not three-thirds of God that make one. You know, stuff like that.
Right.
Because one of the ways he introduces it, I don't think it's in this book, but it's in one of his other things, is God by time clock, you know. When it was time to create the world and lead all these rebellious Israelites around, he called himself Father, and then it was time to save the world, he called himself Son, and then after he ascended into heaven, then it was Spirit because they couldn't see him anymore, kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Anything else on Son compared to Father? I wonder, too, I don't remember reading this in here, but that doesn't necessarily help express the commonality of a unity that we ourselves then are able to have with Jesus as the fact that we all have one Father. And I think that part of that goes into the whole concept of this being Reformation Day today, the concept of justification. There are places in the New Testament that I would argue very strongly against the use of inclusive language and changing the word son from the Greek into children or child as if to de-genderize it. Or to make it inclusive. And the reason is that in those particular passages, I think there are a number of passages where it says sons and it does mean children and it's, you know, needs to be opened up. But in some of those particular passages that the word son is used specifically to refer to the inheritance and the place exchange, this whole concept of justification. In other words, it's talking about the inheritance we get. It is not talking about who we are as the recipients. The focus is coming from the gift and not the recipient of the gift. And I think it actually waters it down to say children instead of sons in some of those cases. I've got one of those little tirades in my sermon Sunday if it survives. So every so often. Because there are places where inclusive language clarifies, especially for the modern reader, you know, the intent of the passage. But there are some of those places where you need to have your ears pricked a little bit when you hear that and think, what do you mean? Women aren't included? No, it has nothing to do with the inclusion at all. This is the gift. This is the swap that was made by the Son, making us sons as the inheritance, you know. Mm-hmm. Anything else on son? Son and father. Son compared to father. All right, well, now we have the marvelous thing of talking about a bunch of heresy here for a little while. Mm-hmm. Docetism.
He only looks human.
Only looks human. Yeah. Isn't it amazing that his footsteps have hardly dried on the Sea of Galilee, you know, hardly gotten washed off the Sea of Galilee for more than 150, 200 years until some of this stuff popped up and said he only looked human?
The way Cole put it, I just kind of chuckled, or I did. God would not be caught dead in human flesh.
Well, but see, that goes back to the whole concept of dualism. And the dualism being that matter is basically evil.
Yeah.
And anybody that believed that would believe then that God would not be caught dead in human flesh, because God would not be caught dead in any kind of material form.
Yeah.
Well,
and
then it never happened that way before. You don't normally think God's walking around.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. Anything else on docetism? From the Greek word dokeo. Adoptionism.
Well, that Jesus was sort of the other approach. Now, he was such a good human that God adopted him.
But he never became fully God as a son, but never fully. He was an adopted son, though, kind of a second class divine extension or something, you know. Mm-hmm. and the Ebionites and the Paul of Samosata and the dynamic monarchianism business. Those are both expressions of adoptionism, types of adoptionism.
Mm-hmm. Are a lot of these heresies that are talked about here still present in religions today?
Yeah, you know, that's why it's so important to know all these things, because as the writer to, who is it, the Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. And it's really basically true.
I guess I've just never thought about the differences in beliefs among the religions as in these kinds of terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes it's not so... on page 130, I made a note on page 130.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
And this is a... Here's what I put down, what I've got typed under my paper. Some mainline Protestants believe that Jesus is nothing more than God's adopted son and thus a model for living. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that most mainline Protestants would not necessarily go so far as either camp of the adoptionist crowd and say that Jesus isn't really God. But consider the letters WWJD for a minute and what that implies. What would Jesus do? You see that stuff plastered on Christian artwork and Christian trinkets and this and that, and Christian bookstores all over the place. What kind of a what kind of attitude does that set towards the way we view Christ?
His model is what we should be doing.
Exactly. Which is goes back ultimately to the way that the adoptionists were looking at him anyway.
Right.
His model for life. Now, does that mean that we're not yet? Yes, we are supposed to model our lives after Christ, and he is, you know, we're supposed to that kind of thing. But to put an overemphasis on what would Jesus do, I always like to kind of come around the other direction and say, first of all, as Lutherans, the notion is not what would Jesus do, but what has Jesus done? And then, by virtue of the fact that I am the heir of that by my baptism, what would I do to live up to what Jesus has already declared me to be? And you can say, well, it's just a matter of semantics, or you're just, you know, coming at it. It is coming from a different direction, though, because instead of just using him as a model, it's a recognition that I have already been declared to be the perfection that Jesus, you know, that's the way God considers me, as being the perfection of Christ by virtue of my baptism. And so I'm just basically living up to what God has called me to be.
Maybe because of my Lutheran upbringing, I guess in essence, even when I see that, it's like a reminder, not that I can be Christ, but how can I be more Christ-like in what I do?
And that's fine.
Yeah, well, another way to say that is the third use of the law.
It is a third use of the law.
And I guess that's the way I've always looked at it.
And that's, you know, well, that's because you're a Lutheran, too. But what I'm seeing, though, is just strikes
not
me.
Not all look at it that way, is the point
right.
I'm making.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's one of those things that Jesus, as a good moral teacher, mm-hmm. you know, you even go to our, you know, go across town to St. John's and talk to some of the parents who are not members of either of these two congregations, who may not necessarily even be all that terribly tied into any congregation, ask them why they got their kids in that school. Good moral education. I think it's wonderful that St. John provides that education, but I think to look at, because, you know, that's the thing we hear over here with our preschool. Same thing. And it tends to be what people see as one of the strong suits. They tend to overcharacterize public education as this malaise of whatever, you know, the immorality or whatever, and I think that's probably a little bit of a mischaracterization. I think that's mischaracterized too. But if that's all they're there for, and I know they're not necessarily all they're there for, but at the same time, it is a real strong emphasis on that part of it as, you know, good moral upbringing kind of thing. especially in the case when they're not when they know their kids are getting Lutheran doctrine, but they're Methodist or whatever. It was very interesting. We had a Baptist girl in the eighth grade class in my vicarage church in the Lutheran school. And of course, whenever we got to the topic of infant baptism, she just went nuts. This was totally against her thing, you know. But it was religion class for a grade. That was what confirmation class was. And every year in the school board meetings and in congregational meetings, it would come up, you know, we have these kids from the other churches that are coming to this school, and why should they be taught things that are, you know, not necessarily consistent with their upbringing and be graded for it? And we're saying, do we have a private school here, a private Christian school, or do we have a Lutheran school? What are we going to do here, you know? And so anyway. Yeah. But that was one of the things I wrote about that, especially from page 130, that whole business of monarchianism, of Jesus is the great model. I think Jesus is a great model for his justified creatures. Mm-hmm. But to make him just a great model for living as a moral teacher, you know, that kind of... Mm-hmm. So anyway, subordinationism.
I don't think that made it on our sheets.
Second
column.
More like a
sub deity, like a semi deity. Mm-hmm. No, mine. That's all right.
Do you have any?
No, I don't have any of those.
Huh.
Wow. Well then.
I thought I looked like a short verse tonight.
Your printer was defective.
Must have been.
My
next page is blank.
Okay.
So, okay.
Okay, subordination
is spiritual ink, invisible.
More than human, but not God.
Yep. A subordinate deity.
In between.
Yep.
Almost like an oxymoron.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
A subordinate deity.
Yeah, but see, that's a real normal concept for back then. We were talking about putting it in terms people understood. You know, if you look at the cultures.
Because there was lots of belief in deities and that kind of thing. We are probably more godless today in the sense of being disconnected to spiritual things, especially the modern era. I think in this more postmodern time, it's kind of coming back around. People is more of an awareness of a generic spirituality, so to speak. In the modern era, if it was not perceivable by the five senses, it was fantasy. Mm-hmm. Believe it if you want, it's your business, you know, kind of thing.
Well, at that time there was a lot of, you know, there were the idols had a kind of a hierarchy.
Yeah.
Pecking order.
Yeah. Some were more powerful, some were bigger shots than others.
Well, yeah, you know, especially in the Old Testament times, basically wars were considered to be actually fought by the gods of the nations. And the victorious god was reflected in the victorious army. More or less. So, which is why the Israelites were so scandalized in 586 when Nebuchadnezzar mowed down the temple and took all the goodies out of it. He was supposed to be the, you know, everybody else was supposed to be fake gods. He's the real one. You know, our God can't lose. And that was one of the things that was really bugging them for many years, and they were sitting in Babylon wondering what was coming next. Our God lost. How can this be? Mm-hmm. And then the prophets were there like Ezekiel, you know, screaming at him, saying, no, your God didn't lost. He beat up on you because you've been so rotten all this time. So, Theotokos. It's the word that Lutherans are afraid of. It shouldn't be.
Well, Mother of God in Greek?
Yes. It's a Greek word for Mother of God. And the Nestorius is the champion of a heresy that basically was willing to call... Nestorius was was the one who came along with the two natures of God in Christ being like two boards glued together. They didn't really interact with one another, but it was kind of like two simultaneously subsisting beings together there. It's another form of dualism. God still isn't really dirtying himself with human being. He just happens to be with the same human being all the time. They're together. They've been permanently joined, but they really don't talk to each other very much, if anything, don't interact. And therefore, Nestorius was willing to call Mary the mother of Christ, the mother of Jesus, but not the mother of God.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was the mother of the human part, is the way he saw it. Monophysitism, followers of a guy by the name of Eutyches, in reaction to Nestorius saying the divine nature was so powerful that it swallowed God right, or swallowed the human nature right up. I mean, you can imagine an electrical engineering graduate in the winter quarter of his seminary year having 10 weeks to try to get inside the heads of all these clowns and figure out all these heresies. I about quit. I'll tell you what, I was, by February, I was contacting Purdue and said, what's the job market look like? I can't do this anymore. I am out of here. I didn't have anything, which is probably the Lord saying, yeah, you're going to stay, dummy.
You said, supposing.
Just suppose. Suppose that I would be a pastor someday. That's right. You're right.
And the bush burned on.
C plus out of that class. Early church. There are some professors at the seminary who are into making good, well-rounded pastors into theologians, giving them practical information, and then there are some that are trying to make purebred theologians, and this guy was one of them. And this engineer was not ready to be a purebred theologian. The whole history department at that school was that way at that time, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Except for one guy. And I managed to get him for every single required history class after that that I needed. One of the ways I survived seminary. Yeah. Okay, now we get into concepts, beginning on page 132, I believe it is, of the personal union, of the hypostatic union. And we talk now about the communication of attributes.
Yeah, where each nature of God shares the attributes.
Yes.
Of the other nature.
Mm-hmm. And there's the threefold genre of the communication of attributes: the genus idiomaticum, the genus maiestaticum, and the genus apotelis moticum. Genus idiomaticum.
Well, that the properties that are peculiar to either being divine or the human nature can be ascribed to the entire Christ.
Yeah, which is why we can call Mary the mother of God. Because she was the mother of his human nature, but because of the communication of attributes, according to the way it is identified in the genus idiomaticum, the human part of him is God too, by being uniquely linked as one person. And this is also how Peter, in his Pentecost Day sermon, looks the bunch right in the eye and says, "You killed the Lord of glory, whom God raised from the dead. You killed God." And I think it was as one of the hymns I like to have sung on Good Friday, but congregations balk at it because they only sing it once a year on Good Friday. It's the O Darkest Wool. The second stanza, O pain and dread, our God is dead, you know, which is an expression of Gainus Idiomaticum. And when you look at that, you talk about the suffering servant concept of the suffering servant that we talked about a little bit earlier. Here is one of the ways in which it's also spelled out a little bit more in the subsequent genre as well, but where you actually have a God who is down on our level, living life on our terms, as opposed to either an appearance or a projection or just a sympathetic being that kind of walks around among us but doesn't really get himself dirty with it. You have a God who can die now. Anything else on the Gainus Idiomaticum? Gainus Maiestaticum.
Isn't this sort of the same thing, just kind of the other direction? The other one, you shared human attributes with the divine, and now you're sharing divine attributes with the human part.
Well, now the other one was that the unique attributes of each can be ascribed to the whole person. This is a direct communication of the majesty divine to the human, giving the human nature, the ability, if you will, to do things that a normal human nature otherwise would not be able to do, such as being present everywhere. Jesus' words of himself in Matthew 28:19, all authority in heaven and on earth have been given to me, that kind of thing. This, by the way, to show you how interwoven theology is, this is actually where the ultimate discussion comes down of the real presence of the Lord's Supper, of the real presence of the body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper between us and the Reformed. This is one of the key things that comes into play. Because effectively, the Reformed, in saying this is not really the body and blood of Jesus, one of the defenses that they use is that true human body and blood, true humanity, could not make itself available as is required for the real presence to be true. And so basically what they're doing is they're denying the Gainus Maiestaticum. It's more in whether or not the Lord's Supper is a representation or is the actual real presence. It actually comes back down to Christology. Which is what we're talking about here. Anything else on the Gainus Maiestaticum? Gainus Apotelismaticum.
This sort of the idea that each nature did its own thing, but with participation and knowledge of the other.
Yeah.
So they weren't acting independently.
Right. And that continues to be the case today, which is another point that the Protestants try to assert in the whole discussion of the real presence versus symbolic presence of the Lord's Supper, and that is that the actual human body of Jesus is encapsulated in 6 feet of heaven someplace. It's kind of stored there. But the divine presence is what's present everywhere. Okay, anything else? Dates and councils and Christological positions. Oh, that's so much fun to memorize all that stuff, too.
Bring it back to memory. It sort of impressed me that after every person had a position, then we followed with a council.
And there were several of them.
To attack that particular issue. And then later on, somebody else had another position. About every 40, 50 years.
Right. And it's also interesting that 325, it follows the Edict of Milan, which is the toleration of Christianity and then actually bringing it into mainstreaming it, was 318. And already it becomes a legitimate religion of the Roman Empire, and then within 8 years, there's a big controversy to be settled.
What happens when you get controversy?
Well, it's also, the devil figured out that beating on it from the outside was not the way to ruin it. Make it popular and get everybody fighting with themselves instead of trying to squish it from the outside. There actually are 7 accepted what are called ecumenical councils, and I couldn't tell you what the other 3 are. They're all after. They're councils that follow up after 451. But those 4 that are talked about, Nicaea, Constantinople, Ephesus, and Chalcedon, are the first 4 of what are considered to be the accepted 7 ecumenical councils. And when I'm talking about that, what I'm saying is this is the entire Christian church on earth, these 7 councils. Because after the 7th council, East and West started looking a little cross-eyed at each other, and then in 1054 mutually excommunicated each other. The Bishop of Rome excommunicated the Metropolitan of Constantinople, and the Constantinople excommunicated the Bishop of Rome, and all of the people that followed each. And that was the great schism that divided Christianity into East and West. And the Roman Catholic Church basically was the Western Church until this day, about how many years ago? Then it just kind of splintered
like a firecracker.
Yep. I sent out a note, those of you who are on Trinity's news list, that I thought was kind of interesting that I picked up from a news thing, and that was that in the year 16, or in the year 1516, now what was it again? In the year 1516, Luther, he preached a sermon against, it was on October the 31st, yeah. It was the eve of All Saints, and he preached a sermon against indulgences. Exactly 1 year before he posted the theses, but then the next year he posted the theses, and it said that sermon started Luther's 30 Years' War, which is kind of a takeoff from the concept of the 30 Years' War of 1618 to 1648 in Europe, because Luther lived exactly 30 years, or not exactly, he lived from 1516 to 1546 after that. He didn't die on October 31st. So, and the Nicene Creed, as you probably read, comes from those first 2 ecumenical councils. It was first formulated, and that's why it's called the Nicene Creed. The actual title is the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed. We know it today as the Nicene Creed. But it was primarily formulated in 325, and then it was finalized in 381, at the Council of 381. And it is the clearest expression, it is the clearest ecumenical expression of the person of Christ, which is why it tends to be the creed of choice for the celebration of communion in Lutheran churches, because it hits both his divine and human nature very clearly. Except we use the Apostles' Creed here at the Summer at Trinity, because otherwise we'd never use the Apostles' Creed. Because we always celebrate communion. So, anything else? I think we're about done.
Going back to the second page, and it was like the second question we had there. I just thought it was interesting. The question was, what two things are affirmed by the doctrine of the virgin birth? And we talked about the virgin nature of Mary and the birth of our God in human flesh. And the note I just kind of put down to myself was, interesting how we're born again in baptism, and yet here's Jesus, who already was God, was born as a human. And then just this continued note, such a servant.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay.